Several years ago, I was flying to Atlanta out of DFW, and I found myself on an airplane with one of those gentlemen. You probably have seen him before, the gentlemen that wear a cap, and on that cap it has whatever part of the military they were in. If they served in the Navy, it would say USS, whatever ship it was. If they were in the Army, it might say their battalion. And I was next to this gentleman. And as we were flying, I just finished watching Band of Brothers, which was an HBO miniseries that was done with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. And as I had watched that, I was overwhelmed with what that generation of military endured and what they went through. And I don't know if you've ever had that moment where you're on an airplane and it seems like it's the longest flight ever. You know, the kind where you wake up, you fall asleep, and then you wake up, and you look at your watch, oh man, that was only like 3 minutes. Then you gotta go to the bathroom, or if you're on the aisle, the person inside of you has to go to the bathroom like 5 times. And then you wake up and you realize the drink cart already passed you, and your shot at a drink is gone. Well, I sat there and talked to this gentleman the entire flight. It was the fastest flight ever. Tell me about your hat. Tell me where you fought. Tell me what you saw. Tell me what you did. And it was the most incredible thing. And from that point in time, I became really, really engaged in what that would have been like and what Normandy Beach would have been like. And New Orleans, Louisiana has what was called the D-Day Museum. Now it's called the National World War II Museum. It's the only World War II museum we have. But upon going there, I want to show you this graphic. This is what was going on in the beginning of World War II. Those are little army men on shelves, and each one of the army men represents 2,000 troops. And when you look at that, right off the bat, you can tell that Japan has a larger military than us. Germany had a larger military than us. And you can tell it's a sizable advantage. But let me tell you how sizable it was. At the time that World War II started, Japan had a military of 4,600,000. The German army was 100,000 less. They were 4,500,000. And the little bitty United States military with 635,000. We're outnumbered almost by 4 million soldiers twice. Right? Because we're fighting Germany in the east and we're fighting Japan in the west, and that's still our military taking on two militaries that size. Some might call that a slight disadvantage. Why would you do it? I think Band of Brothers captures it well in this first clip. See, we came across something that was so horrendous and so horrific, we had to engage it. And by the way, the people that are engaging it are your age. These soldiers that are going are your age. And it was a big day. It was June 6th. Here are some numbers for you about what a big deal this was. It was led by General Dwight Eisenhower. He was a 5-star. You've heard of 4-star generals. 5-star generals are when you're over a multinational force. And so they gave Dwight Eisenhower a 5th star because he was running all of the countries that invaded Normandy. He was in charge of all of it. That's why he got a 5th star. Here was the invasion. There were 160,000 soldiers that landed on the beach that day. 73,000 of them were Americans, 61,000 were British, 21,000 were Canadian. There were 195,000 naval and merchant navy personnel that were located on 5,000 ships coming across the English Channel that day. We're not talking about a small maneuver, we're talking about a huge maneuver. Those numbers are staggering. 5,000 naval vessels going across simultaneously, carrying all of those people. Their goal was to take a stretch of beach that was only 50 miles wide. That's not even here to Decatur. Okay? And those were the numbers of people that were all coming in at the same time to deal with the evil that was creating that stuff. They were your age. And as they fight, we get to know them through Band of Brothers. But one of the great things, if you buy the DVD set, is they have an extra disc. And it's actually the people portrayed in the series being interviewed, and they're talking about it. And so the people that you've been watching actors portray through 10 episodes, you're actually now seeing the real men, and it was done in 2002, speaking about it. And what those men fought for and what they engaged in changed their lives forever. Listen to the way they talk about it. As we go through tonight, you're going to get to hear about two people that Paul feels very close with. And when you listen to those men, like I said, that at the time when they're landing on the beach, they're your age. That group of men were part of a generation of men that changed the world. They liberated the world from Hitler, and they liberated the world from Japan. So if you've been of the mind that you can't make a difference, what part can you play? I want to tell you that you come in a long line of generations that have changed the world in your age group. What you do matters. And we're going to talk about two people that have been a part of Paul's life. And like those people said, you know what? We may not have gotten rich, but we're rich in the things that matter. You might have heard him say, you know what? It's uncanny the way we connect with each other. After all these years, the one guy that said, you know what? We get back together and it's like I go back in time and I'm that age all over again. Because there's something about going through hard times together when you rub shoulders with each other and you have to depend on each other. And one of the things that's wrong with our culture is this idea that you can do it by yourself. God never intended for you to do it by yourself, but our Americana culture loves to say that we pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. Look what I did. I did it my way. I did it all alone. And we like and we herald people that are self-reliant. God never intended for you to be self-reliant. He intended for you to be reliant on Him, and that He put you into the middle of something called the body of Christ, where He said when you put all of you together, you have every bone, every muscle, every supporting ligament to be a completely healthy, functioning body. God built it that way. We're the ones that screwed it up. And when we come to this passage, we're going to see two people that Paul feels very strongly about. Chapter 2, verse 19. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon so that I may, that I too may be cheered by news of you. For I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how a son with a father he has served with me in the gospel. I hope therefore to send him just as soon as I see how it goes with me, and I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also. He's commending Timothy. He's looking at Timothy and saying, I'm going to send Timothy to you. Now, Timothy is that one that Paul elsewhere said, don't let anybody look down on you because you're young. Because there's that tendency when we're on the younger side of the spectrum to say, I can't really make a difference. I'm just a kid. Nobody really pays attention to me. It doesn't really matter what I do. And Paul's already told Timothy, Timothy, you got to put that thinking behind you. Because God has great things for you, Timothy, and you don't need to apologize for your age. Really, your age can be a real strength. So Timothy, don't let people look down on you. You go out there and live the life that I'm calling you to live and go do it. And Timothy did it. Those guys on the video, they went and did it. We look at this. I hope to send Timothy to you. He's in prison, remember? He's in prison. And so he's looking around. He's like, okay, this church in Philippi that I love so much, they need some help. They need to be encouraged. What they have is they know that I'm in prison. And that might be something that's discouraging to them. And so what I want to do is I want to go, I want to be with them, I want to encourage them, but I'm kind of chained up right now. I can't really do that. Who do I trust enough for me to send in my place to go minister to these people. I'm going to tell you, you will find that you will, whoever you want to imitate, that you will take on not only their strengths, but you will take on their weaknesses. Be careful who you put in front of you as a mentor. Whoever you put in that role, you will become like them. Paul says he'd been working with Timothy. Don't let people look down on you. Timothy is almost this version of a carbon copy of who Paul is. So when Paul says, I can't go, let me send somebody in my place because I'm kind of chained up. Timothy. Timothy is who I'm going to send. And so he said, that I may too be cheered by news of you. He's locked up. It's not like there's an internet. He doesn't get internet time. He doesn't get emails or text messages. I'm going to send Timothy to you. That will encourage you. And then Timothy's going to come back and he's going to tell me how you're doing. And the expectation is remember last time, whether I'm absent or not, you're going to be growing in the Lord. The idea is that when Timothy comes back, he's going to say, okay, let me tell you about this. And guess what else? Guess what else is happening? People are coming to the Lord. The church is growing. People are coming to faith. Oh, you wouldn't believe this. Oh man, they're growing in their faith. Man, so-and-so had this tough struggle going on, but they fought through it. They prayed through it. The Lord showed up in big ways. They didn't know how that was going to happen, but they trusted, and look at what the Lord did. See how great that is? When that happens in my life and in your life, do you rejoice? Man, isn't God good? I was visiting with somebody that left on our church trip to India today, and she was telling me, oh man, since the point I stepped forward, I said, yeah, I want to go to India. She's like, you won't believe what happened. And she started telling me stories. And she's just, woo, 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 woo. I mean, she was excited. Matter of fact, she told me today before she left. She said, I'm sorry. I was babbling in your office the other day. And I said, it's okay. You were so excited to tell me what the Lord was doing to make this possible. How could I turn you away? And how could I be bored listening to my Lord work in your life? See, we don't have enough of that. When we get together, we're like, oh man, let's share a prayer request. Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to pay the bills. I don't know how I'm going to pass the test. Mom and Dad want me to come home for the summer. I don't want to go home this summer. I want to do this. My car needs tires. They're bald. I don't know how I'm going to get new tires. Our time together looks more like that. We need more times where we get together and say, hey, let me tell you what the Lord did in my life this week. Paul's looking at him saying, you know what? I'm going to send Timothy. He's going to cheer you up. But when he comes back, he's going to cheer me up because I'm going to hear how the Lord's working in your life. For I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. They all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. Is there a sadder commentary than that? I'm thankful I have Timothy to send to you because if I'm real honest, people like Timothy are in very short supply. There aren't just very many people in the world that are committed to the interests of the Lord Jesus Christ and are not committed to their own personal interests. If I were to ask you right now to come up with a list in your brain, some of you would be hard-pressed to come up with one. I think we'd all have a hard time coming up with five. Could we come up with 10? Man, that'd be hard. Paul's commendation here is, I don't have anybody else like him. I mean, certainly, if good people attract good people, you'd expect the best people to be around Paul, right? You've heard that. Good people attract good people. You would expect Paul to be flocked with good people. I got one. I got Timothy. I got Timothy. Now, let's be honest. We were talking about to live as Christ, to die as gain. Talk about Paul. He's in prison. He's got one person that's committed to the interests of who? The Lord Jesus Christ, not his own. Paul's in prison. You don't think the one person in his world that's committed to the Lord Jesus Christ's interest, that he wouldn't want that guy with him in prison? But Paul is so selfless, he's like, you know what? This will be okay. The Lord will sustain me. And right now, as great as Timothy could be for me, I feel like the Lord might prefer to use Timothy in your life. So as valuable as he is to me, I'm going to send him on to you. I can't fathom that level of selflessness. But you know Timothy's proven worth. You know his proven worth. I want to tell you, character cannot be built overnight. It doesn't get built overnight. Your character, who you are as a man or a woman, gets built over a long period of time. And people look at, that's why when people start dating and they want to know, well, how long should you date before you get engaged? I don't know. How important is the person, how important is it to you that you marry the right person? And can you figure out a person in 3 months? Can you figure them out in 6 months? Because what we want is we want a track record so we can look, so that when we see it, we can identify it. I remember talking to a teller once. You don't study counterfeit money because tomorrow there'll be a new way to counterfeit a dollar bill. You study the real dollar bill so that you know it so well that when a fake one comes across your hand that you can say, well, this one does it, this one isn't right. I can't even tell you why it's not right, but it's not right. Something's wrong because I know the original so well. Think about the person that you date. You want to have enough of a track record that when a behavior or an action comes, that you can look and say, that doesn't fit. But if you don't have enough of a track record, you don't know which one's real and which one's fake. Look at Timothy. Look at how good he is. Look at how strong he is. He's got this proven character to who he is as a man. How a son, his father, has served with me in the gospel. I hope therefore to send him just as soon as I see how it goes with me. There's some level where he's looking around and he's saying, he obviously had a legal thing that was coming due. I need to find out what's going to happen with me. He's already said, I don't know if I'm going to die in prison or not. But he said, I'm going to wait just a little bit longer. I'm waiting on this decision to see how it goes with me. But here's the plan. I am sending Timothy to you, and Lord willing, I will be coming right after him. We're both coming. Because you can't have too much encouragement, right? Why are we not more free with encouraging other people? It's like, well, we don't want them to get the big head. Like, I'm going to run out of encouraging words in my vocabulary. I promise you, you will not run out of encouraging words. Give them away. Give them away liberally. All the time. Paul's like, you know what? I'm going to send Timothy, and man, I'm right on his path if I can get out of there. I read that and I think, wow. Paul refers to him, do you catch that? Have literally no one like him. Some passages will say that he was like-minded. There was nobody like-minded with him. And that phrase speaks of we're kind of like we're one soul. We have this one soul between Timothy and me. So I want to send him to you. At some point in your life, you may come to this very awkward thing. Ellen and I came to it. We had met with our, you know, it's about the time where you finally figure out that you have to get a lawyer in your world because you have to come up with a will. And you got to figure out who's going to get the life insurance money if you die. And you got to figure out who's going to take care of your kids. So it's this weird time where Ellen and I sit down and we're like, okay, so we're dead. Who do we want to take care of our two children? Who do we want? Let me tell you, that's a weird conversation. Because you know what we kept coming back to? We think the Lord wants us to be their mom and dad. That's why he gave them to us. Okay, fine, okay, granted. But let's just say we die in a plane crash going somewhere without them. What do we do then? And so we start the conversation. And you don't get to have this conversation all at once. At least I can't, because my wife becomes very emotional and we hit the inevitable brick wall that says, I don't want to talk about this anymore. So you're like, okay. Can we just pick up here next time? Or do we have to start back at scratch? And so you know what? Finally we get to this point where we look around and the conversation is this. Okay. Who do we think has a similar marriage philosophy to Ellen and I? Who is it that we think has a marriage like ours? That we're family-centric. Our kids didn't make us a family. We were a family. And then within our family, when God gave us children, we welcomed them into our family. We were a family long before we had kids. And we were committed to not giving our kids whatever they wanted. And we were committed to not being our kids' friends. We were committed to being our kids' parents. And we were committed to disciplining them. and being consistent. So you look around and you think, okay, who else do we see doing that? You know who you don't ask? You don't ask somebody that you're like, hey, nice to meet you at church today. You want to go to lunch? Hey, I couldn't help but notice we sure have easy conversation at lunch today on the day we met you. You want to watch our kids if we die? No, you look at a proven track record. And you say, who has a like-minded soul with us? And then you pray about it. You talk about it. And then you go and have the most awkward conversation with somebody. We're like, okay, if we die, we'd like to ask you to raise our children. Would you prayerfully consider that? Paul's looking at Timothy and he's saying, Timothy, if something happens to me in prison, that church in Philippi is going to need somebody like you to love them, to grow with them, to speak to them, to encourage them. And if they get out of line, to say something hard to them, and I'm counting on you to do that. This is a huge task. This is no small thing. This is, who is going to represent me to go into that? He thinks Timothy's up for it. So while he had to start telling Timothy stuff like, don't let people look down on you because you're young. Because he's looking at Timothy saying, God has big plans for you. And it doesn't matter if you don't think you're ready. I don't know what's going to happen to me in prison. And the fact is, there's only one person in my world that has the heart I do for those people, and it's you. So I want you to be ready to go. Man, those are strong words. Look at this next one. This next one is a guy named Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus, we find out later in the book, is from this church. And Epaphroditus was sent to see Paul in prison, and he came bearing financial gifts to Paul while he's in prison to meet his need. So this church, you know, it's not just that Paul loves this church in Philippi. This church loves Paul as well. And so when they said, Paul's in prison, he's struggling, let's send Epaphroditus to him, but we're going to send Epaphroditus with some gifts for him, and he's going to go. So that's what is happening. And now we come to verse 25. Paul writes this, I thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker, fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. Okay? Catch all those words. I wonder who you would say is your fellow anything. My fellow soldier, my fellow worker. Catch his level of commitment to this guy. We're together. We're together. It's the image of what we get in there. Because when we fight through battles, when we have hard times, we don't forget those people. Our hearts are knit together with those people. Because what the last guy said when he said, you know, when we get together at these reunions, we're back. It's just like we were when we enlisted back in the army. I'm the same way. You have enough battles in your life where you grow spiritually and you have a chance to sit down with them and you just kind of pick up right where you left off. Epaphroditus, my brother, my fellow worker, he's right here with me. He's in the task with me to get this done. My fellow soldier, he is fighting the battle for me, for my soul, for you, your soul. Do you have a fellow soldier? Messenger and minister to me. For he'd been longing for you all, and he's been distressed because you heard he was ill. Epaphroditus carried the message and the gifts to Paul, and when he got to Paul, he got really sick. So word got back to Philippi. Epaphroditus, he's sick. He's real sick. And Epaphroditus, because he cares, he wants him to know he's going to be okay. So he's nervous. How am I going to communicate that to him? I don't want them worried for me for no reason. For he's been longing for you and he's been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill. Matter of fact, he was so ill, catch this, he was near death. This isn't like he got a cold. No, he's on his deathbed. And guess what? All those people back there, loving and caring for him, they're worried about him. And because he feels that love, he doesn't want them to worry about him. He wants to say, hey, I'm better, I'm okay. I've recovered. He was ill. Matter of fact, he was near to death. But God had mercy on him. And not only on him, on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. So not only was Epaphroditus sick, the Lord had mercy on him because he restored his health. Because the Lord does that. But catch who else God had mercy on. Paul said, Epaphroditus is sick. He had mercy on Epaphroditus because Epaphroditus got well. And they said, God also had mercy on me because Epaphroditus got well. You know anybody gets sick? You know what it's like to suffer with somebody that's sick? He said, man, my heart was so good when I found out Epaphroditus was well. Hear that level of connection. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. The idea being, look, here's the deal. Epaphroditus is coming back to you. I don't want you to think it's because he failed at his mission to me. I'm sending him back. Because I think that there is more good with him coming to you for you to see his health than for me keeping him here. Again, do you hear his selflessness? Have you ever felt alone? Have you ever felt so alone that you thought, I just wish somebody was here? Now, if you've had that moment, you don't even have to talk to them. Where you're content just to have them in the room. You're content to just have them nearby you. So you know they're there. You don't need them to speak. You don't even need them to listen. You just want somebody there. This is Paul. He's got Timothy, his true, he would say his son in the faith, and he's got Epaphroditus who was sent there to care for him. He is still in prison. And he's saying, you know what? I care about you so much. I'm willing to send you my Timothy, and I'm willing to send you back Epaphroditus because I am so concerned for where you are, not looking not only to his own interest, but looking to their interest. That's huge. Verse 29. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. Receive him back. Receive him back because he almost gave his life for the cause of Christ. He almost gave his life for the cause of Christ. You receive him back. He didn't flake out. He didn't give up. He didn't abandon me. I'm sending him back to you for you to love and care for. For goodness sakes, he almost died. He's coming back to you. He almost died on my account. One translation that I read in preparing for this, it's got a phrase similar to the lines of, he didn't regard his own interest. He was willing to regard the interests of Christ. It didn't matter if he died. He was doing what Christ called him to. Do we hear that echo? To live as Christ, to die as gain. Because I told you a few minutes ago that we will become who our mentors are. Is it any wonder that when Timothy spends time with Paul or when Epaphroditus spends time with Paul, that they come to the same conclusion that to live as Christ and to die as gain? Because that stuff rubs off. If I just tell it to you, you'll say, oh man, that's a good thought. That's pretty deep. Maybe that's profound. But when you live alongside somebody and you rub shoulders with them and that's the way they live, you can't help but be affected by it. And Paul's leaving that impact on everybody he runs across. Some are picking it up, some aren't. He's already told you there was nobody else like Timothy. Nobody else. It didn't mean that Paul was different with Timothy than he was with everybody else. It just means Timothy picked up on it. Here's where I'd want to encourage you guys. You find somebody in your life that you respect, and you respect their walk with Christ, and you start rubbing shoulders with them. And let that rub off on who you are. You will become like the person that you seek as a mentor. And sometimes a mentorship is a real person. Sometimes it's a book. Sometimes it's a podcast. I've been mentored by a lot of people that are dead. because I read their writings and they affect me deeply. I'll share one with you now. You probably have heard of the name Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. And I don't agree with everything Bonhoeffer says in the book. That's okay. I don't agree with everything I say either. But Bonhoeffer says some things that are pretty outlandish. And sometimes, do you ever have that person that says things so strongly that they don't ever think you'll get all the way here, but if they just kind of move you a few steps, it's success? I'm not quite sure. Bonhoeffer writes in there, when Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die. I have no problem with that sentence. That the call to follow Christ means that we die to ourselves and we put Christ in that position of calling the shots in our life. I have no problem with that. But here's part of why I don't have a problem with it, because he is so incredible in the way that he lived his life. Listen to this. Bonhoeffer was in Germany at the time when this stuff started that we saw earlier. That was Bonhoeffer's Germany. And he was part of the Christian church, and Nazism wanted to claim Christianity. Matter of fact, it started a new brand of the church that they called the Confessing Church, because they said, no, Christianity is not the same as Nazism. No matter how hard Hitler tries to marry those two, they don't fit together. So they created a church, and they called it the Confessing Church. But in that, that's Bonhoeffer. Because he was an academic and a pastor, he had the chance to leave and go to America. So he comes to America, and as he's spending time over here, he finds that he is drawn to go back to Germany, which almost means certain death for him. But I want you to listen to his words, because one of his Christian academics here in the United States, named Reinhold Niebuhr, said, "What are you doing? Don't go back to Germany." And Bonhoeffer wrote this, that if he did not go back and participate in the sufferings of the church of Germany during this time, that he would not be able to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if he didn't share in the trials of this time with my people. Talk about a stud. He's looking and saying, you know what? I'm cozy in America. I'm safe. But you know what? I'm going to go back to Germany. Because what's going to happen is, if I don't stay in Germany now with the church, when this is over, they're going to say, where were you? Where were you? You flaked out on us. You had the golden ticket to go to the United States because you were an academic. You didn't know what it was like to have them come door to door. You don't understand what we went through. You don't understand the persecution we endured. So he said, you know what? I'm going to go back and I'm going to live in the middle of it so that when this whole thing is over, we're going to fix it and we're going to win people to Christ and the church will rebound and we're going to be strong again. Sadly, he was arrested in April of 1943 by the Gestapo. He was executed by hanging in April of 1945 while imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. 23 days before the Germans surrendered. 23 days. Is that a waste? Or is that somebody that said to live as Christ and die as gain? And he had his vision that said, if I'm going to be a part of this when it's over, I've got to start dying to myself today so that Christ may live through me. And if that means concentration camp, so be it. Because I want to be a part of what God's going to do in Germany when this is all over. How could we not be encouraged by a man who lives his faith out like that? I think if Paul would have known him, I think he would have said, you got it. You read my letter to the Philippians, to live as Christ, die as gain. And Bonhoeffer would have said, right on. That's why I went back to Germany. And Paul would have said, tell me again. Tell me the story again. And we said, well, you know, I thought that there was going to be, when Hitler was gone, that dude wasn't going to last. And I thought the church is going to come back. He said, and so what'd you do? I decided I was going back, man. There were people to be won for Christ. And I wanted to remove any stumbling block. And I just thought somebody might throw a stone at me and say, you left us. I read about guys like Bonhoeffer and I think, what an incredible stud. In the same way that those guys, I can't imagine. I was at that museum in New Orleans and they've got what they call, you've seen the pictures of them before. They were called the Higgins Landing Craft. And New Orleans got the museum because Andrew Higgins was a New Orleans shipmaker. Those boats that would come up on the shoreline, you've seen them where the front door falls down. They said, we didn't know how we were going to land on a beach because you don't want to go to a dock. It's not like we're going to put out a bridge on a dock and have our military come off it. We had to storm a beach. And so they said, matter of fact, Eisenhower said that we won the war because of Higgins' boats. So these boats come up and they run up on the shore and they drop those doors and you charge out. Oh my. Can you imagine the fear? I'm sitting there in the museum and this is years and years. I mean, this is six decades since the war. And I'm talking to a gentleman who is there and he's showing me the boat and he's showing me how it works. And he said, I said, do these really float? He goes, man, these really float. He said, we took them out in Lake Pontchartrain. And he said, and we're going around Lake Pontchartrain in the boat. And he was one of the guys that stormed the beach. And he said, we're riding around Lake Pontchartrain in the boat. And we come up and all of a sudden we didn't know what he was doing. He said, he rammed this landing craft up on the shore of the lake and he dropped that door. And all of a sudden, every one of these grown men that fought there 60 years later are sitting there and said, we can't move. We're paralyzed by fear because we still hear the bullets. We still hear the gunfire. We still hear the cries of our soldiers that are dying alongside us. You know what the call is? The call is to get out of the boat. And Paul found somebody in Timothy that when the landing craft door opened, that Timothy ran out of the boat. Epaphroditus ran out of the boat. And the call for you and me is to run out of the boat. Dietrich Bonhoeffer got it. The question is, will you and I do it? Because there is a generation of people that are looking around to see if you and I have the proven track record to say that we live the life that demonstrates that to live is Christ and die is gain. I tell you what, if it wasn't for Jesus and what he did for me and what he did for you, none of us would do it. Are you willing to do it for him? Let's pray.